With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're listening to Damian Richardson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, I've just had an update from a supporter of the show. It's got, you know, communications directly to my phone. And this supporter has told me that is to be careful about investing in the solar panels that the Albanese government is so generously offering me taxpayers' rebates to install, because there's Australia is facing a crisis of solar panels. There's some 450,000 ton mountain of used panels that are sitting in landfill. They need to be disposed of, and I think it's there's properties in them. I think like lithium, there's certain precious metals anyway used in the manufacture of these solar panels that don't make them so easy to necessarily dispose of. So, and they're saying by 2040, when we go to net zero. Well, it won't be zero waste, that's for sure. There's going to be like 2 billion ton of mountain ton of panels that will need to be disposed of. And for all of the conservative politicians concerned about being associated with neo-Nazis as part of the drag queen story time as the Monash Council, you don't have to worry anymore, because they've cancelled. The Monash Council have capitulated to the pressure that has been placed on them by the ratepayers of that community, who don't want their children to be indoctrinated with sexual perversion that is a drag time story hour for children. They've cancelled it because they're scared of the Nazis attending. What sort of a message is that sending to people, that it's the Nazis that will get their way? It's not the concerned citizens, the concerned burghers of Monash, residents, ratepayers, who are frightening the councillors. It's the threat of the Nazis. Do you think that's, if that's the statement they've actually made, do you think the Nazis are going to take that as a victory? Do you think they're going to say, great, that's great, we're doing a great job? I'm sure it's going to embolden them. So I would have thought if anyone was talking to Monash Council about their messaging, they might have even considered messaging them that that's not necessarily the best message to say. Why not say we've heard the voice of the people and we've decided not to spend their money on paying drag queens to teach, to talk? And they call them educators. They don't call them performers, because language is all very important. Of course, they call them educators. They're going to educate the children. These children are 1 to 6. 1 to 6. Sitting at the in front of the drag queen who's reading them a story. What for? Because it's an attack on the children, quite deliberately, because that's what happens. You get the children in, you get him in early. I was talking to a guy today, I'm going to talk to him tomorrow. He's part of a school council, and as part of his school council, he got involved because his daughter in year 7 had to tell the teacher what her pronouns would be when she was 13. She had to say what her pronouns were going to be. No, sorry, she's 13 now, but she wasn't 13, obviously, in year 7. And he said, well, we never even had that conversation at home. She was just a child. She was just a girl. She had always been a girl. And now suddenly she had to decide, which is they, them, she, her, or maybe she could have gone all the way and gone, he, him. Let's see what they do with that. I like that American, there's American politician who's come out and he's said, well, he identifies now as a woman and he's done nothing to change his appearance. I think he's in Delaware. And he said he doesn't just identify as a woman, he identifies as a woman of color. He identifies as an Indian woman. And those people, those social justice warriors that tell us how important it is to believe someone and take them at their word if they tell you who they are, have pushed back and said this guy's not taking it seriously. He's making a mockery, and there should be a law against what he's saying because it doesn't make any sense. Well, Isn't that what the rest of us have been saying all along? I mean, if you're going to dress up as a woman, a man, you're a man by all means. Who's going to stop you? And who's going to really care to stop you? This is all being, people are just caring about it now, of course, because it's being pushed in our faces all the time, including in the education of our children. And this guy I'm talking to tomorrow, he's coming on the show. Cameron, he's said that he spoke up at a meeting at the council. He spoke up and he felt like that lonely voice. He took the plunge that it is sometimes to speak up when people are just acquiescing to something that you feel in your heart of hearts isn't right. And what will happen if you speak up? You will no longer be accepted as part of the crowd, part of the pack. He took that risk. And then he said another woman came out and said yes. Her son was so disturbed at having to go to Ida Hobbit Day, you know, which is a day against discrimination of anyone as far as the rainbow flag is concerned. But it's not the only day they have. They have the day we have to dress up in purple as well. And his son just didn't want to, her son didn't want to be coerced into it. And she spoke so for such a long period of time and so vehemently in the end that she apologized to my friend Cameron. She said, "I'm sorry, you brought it up at the meeting. And I'm sorry, I sort of took over." And he said, No. Not at all. I'm glad you took over, because in me speaking up, it obviously gave her the courage to speak up as well. And suddenly it wasn't just one person standing against the crowd. There was two of them united, having a conversation. And I think that's a part of the conversation. I hope we've been part of it here on TNT Radio that has closed down Drag Time Story Hour, because this is an ongoing battle. It's an ongoing cultural battle. And it's not one that the conservative or right side of politics often wins, and it's only part of the battle. The war will continue, the culture war that we've vacated the playing field from. I also noticed that Bud Light is losing lots and lots and lots of money. We're almost to the point where Bud will no longer be the iconic beer brand in the US. So maybe there is some positive signs. For a complete list of shows and our schedule offered on TNT Radio, simply visit our website at tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and other not so credible expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction, truth from propaganda, right here on TNT Radio.
The latest headlines.
Politics are getting out of control.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Green Senator Maureen Faruqi says Pauline Hanson's over. Sues Pauline Hanson. I'm going to start this again. See, I said not all of the hosts are credible, and I meant myself, and then I wanted to prove it. Green Senator Maureen Faruqi sues Pauline Hanson over an insulting and humiliating tweet. TNT Radio News producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy.
Thanks, Damien. Well, Green Senator and Deputy Leader as well, Maureen Faruqi, is suing One Nation Leader Pauline Hanson in the federal court under the Racial Discrimination Act over a tweet telling her to, quote, piss off back to Pakistan. Now, Senator Faruqi's lawyers allege Senator Hanson breached Section 18C of the Act, which makes it unlawful to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate another person or group. Senator Faruqi's lawyers argue the tweet did offend, insult, humiliate, and intimidate their client and other people who share attributes with her. The lawyers requested the tweet to be deleted and replaced with a post pinned to her profile for 3 months, stating she committed unlawful offensive behaviour. In addition, Senator Faruqi's lawyers request the court to require Senator Hanson pay $150,000, it's a huge amount of money, I think, to a not-for-profit chosen by their client and commits to anti-racism training. Senator Faruqi says this court action is about holding Senator Hanson accountable and using the Racial Discrimination Act to prevent her from engaging in bigoted conduct that hurts people in the future. Being told to go back to where we come from is the ultimate racist dog whistle because it tries to rob you of your belonging to the place you call home and paints you as un-Australian, she says. I think, Damien, that we will be hearing a lot more about this story before too long.
She's the one that went after Anzac Day at one particular point in time. I can't remember exactly what she said, Maureen Faruqi, but she went after Anzac Day for some look, I might be wrong, so I don't want to commit to that because I could be wrong. But I'm sure I've heard her discriminate quite often against, you know, people who are considered of a more traditional basis of this population. This is what the people do, isn't it? They just rush to anti-discrimination commissions under the old 18C, part of the Racial Discrimination Act, which people have suggested should even be removed from the Act, but no one's had the courage to do it yet. How serious an attack on free speech is this sort of legal action going to be, Jeremy?
I think it's a very serious assault on freedom of speech. Now, I'm not in any way trying to defend Pauline Hanson. I personally don't think her tweet was appropriate, but that's just me. Look, she's entitled, as far as I'm concerned, to free speech, but it seems that she's not because we have a Racial Discrimination Act. And to my mind, that's a hell of a lot of money going to a non-profit organisation chosen by the client, in other words, Senator Faruqi herself. Now, what if that particular non-profit charity happens to be Greenpeace or the Worldwide Fund for Nature or any one of these green groups, which, of course, a green senator would adore, presumably. What if it was one of those? How is that fair? Because you offend someone and then you would have to fork out a hell of a lot of money to an organisation which you would certainly oppose everything that they stand for.
It's just politics, isn't it, now? We've created all these tribunals. Actually part of the political process because Hanson's colleague in New South Wales, Mark Latham, is before the Anti-Discrimination Commission. Alex Greenwich, the independent member for Sydney, is going to take Latham to the Discrimination Commission for comments he made about his homosexuality, or unless Latham apologises, which Latham said he's not going to do. Do you think once these people go to these discrimination tribunals at the time, it gets up the ire of much of the population and that actually someone like Hanson could potentially benefit from this putative legal action that Faruqi's talking about?
I think that Pauline Hanson could potentially benefit, Damien. It's a bit hard to say because if the courts really stamp down hard on Pauline Hanson, it's not good news. And no matter how much sympathy she will get, which I think would be justified sympathy, nonetheless, it's a hell of a hit to take. And if that is the culture we're in, we're just all going to clam up and be frightened of saying anything. And I think that's just very sad for democracy, Damien.
Well, I think this is ultimately the sort of cause of racism as an anti-white slur in a country that was predominantly white once upon a time, and people think that their behaviour was acceptable. Now it's no longer acceptable, so it'll just make ultimately white people start to identify as a particular group, and there's just no end of the trouble. Honestly, it's the that could occur from these things. Jeremy Beck, thanks so much for that report. You are listening to TNT Radio.
Jeremy Nell on TNT Radio.
I went to watch Monster Trucks with my guy friends. My wife went with a girlfriend to walk through a flower garden.
Yeah. There you go. Pure archetype. And we can't forget that. I think the culture really wants us, again, going back into the shadow, into the darkness of what's going on out of the light of the monster truck. That I used to think was just evolutionary, but now I believe that it is part of an agenda. You know, this idea of trying to essentially steamroller the archetypal differences and just make them
exactly
all one.
Right.
There's no place for that difference. And it, you know, this idea of equality, people don't seem to understand that equality is equality in values, not equality in physical things. There is, or archetypal things. It's more of which is more valuable, the male archetypes or the masculine archetypes or the feminine archetypes. And it's like they're both equally valuable. So there is an equality.
Yes.
But not in the actual way they're presented or displayed. There isn't.
Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Hear about it.
I don't even know where to start with AOC.
Talk about it.
The stupidity of this administration.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
It's good talking to Jeremy before listening to that news report. It's ultimately the identity politics, which seems to be all politics. Maybe it was always all politics. It was a different identity politics, obviously, when it was like a working class against a more established class or a wealthier class, an aristocratic class, if you like. I mean, I don't want to use pejorative words, but now it's changed into personal identity, and that's why I've got my next guest to come on. He's a regular on the show. It's John McBride. He grew up in an active Labor Party family, and he gave up on them after the Keating's term, which was just too woke for him, and he joined the Democratic Labor Party, and he ended up actually working as a parliamentary advisor in the Victorian Legislative Council for a DLP member. John McBride, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Appreciate that.
Now, good having you, mate. Now, so I came across this article in The Australian today and again, I felt like the writer in The Australian, everyone says this is sort of, you know, radically right-wing newspaper, The Australian, the Murdoch stable. But this article was really praising this book written by former Labor parliamentarian Susan Ryan, who died in 2020. You know, eulogising Whitlam, as it so often does, and this time specifically about women and Whitlam, published, of course, by the Whitlam Institute. This is like the genesis of the identity politics movement that now plays out in Australian politics, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's interesting, isn't it? When was Whitlam thrown out? 75? In the Hawke and Keating years, it was an insult to call another Labor member a Whitlamite because they believed he'd gotten so wrong on so many different levels. And here we see ourselves in 2023 with a state socialist government and a federal socialist government. Whitlam would be delighted.
There's legislation just been passed in Ireland to protect people from hate speech because of their, you know, protected characteristics. And it puts the – and what does that even mean? And it puts the onus on the person who may have even been just holding material that's critical of another group. It puts the onus on them that they're going to use it for some nefarious purposes, that they've got to prove their innocence, not their guilt. And this is what we're talking about, though, aren't we, with Whitlam. And this is like Susan Ryan, who wrote this, she helped create the Sex Discrimination Act in 1984, then the Affirmative Action Equality Equal Opportunity Act in 1986. She worked as a minister in the Hawke government from 83 to 88 as a minister assisting the Prime Minister for the status of women. Then in 88 to 87, she was the Minister for Education. Then she was the minister, Special Minister for State from 87 to 88. And then from 2011 to 2016, she was the Age Discrimination Commissioner within the Australian Human Rights Commission. This woman made a career out of nothing but being a professional identity politics bureaucrat.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
The rest of us have to pay for it.
Yeah, what's the legacy? What's the legacy of Susan Ryan and just that entire agenda. Are we better off today as a society than we were with the old norms in place? And you know, I think the answer to that is no. No, we're not, by any metric. So what have they actually achieved? Not a lot, I don't think. But as you say, they're champions of identity politics. And because of identity politics, one of the things that identity politics trails behind it is the discrimination acts. They outlaw any criticism of those policies or people that champion those policies, and it's almost ironic when you look at it that if Ireland's an example, just actually having in your possession something that a tribunal deems inappropriate is in breach of the legislation. I mean, it's a form of Orwellian madness, really, isn't it?
Well, it's actually a prisonable offence.
Well, it's lucky there's no death penalty. I can just say that. It's lucky that we got rid of the death penalty, because I'm sure they'll be advocating for that, or re-education camps or something similar. That's typical of the Marxists. If they can't re-educate you, they shoot you. We've got enough points in history. Pol Pot, Mao, Stalin. So if they don't like you, they'll starve you and cut you off from the economic prosperity. It's frightening. But, yeah, getting back to
the neoconservatives too did it too, didn't they, with the extraordinary rendition. So it's not just – it's across the board. Anyway, you were going to say something.
Well, I think that's fair to say that too, yeah. Look, authoritarian governments, by their nature, will take away your human rights to get to whatever ends. Anything that stops them from exercising the power as they see fit is an inconvenience, and they'd like to get rid of it. I think that's fair enough. That's the way they are. But if you want to go back to the Marriage Act, the no-fault divorce, and what was that? If you look at the legislation as it stood, it was quite onerous, and probably. I mean, I don't know if I'd like to get married under that system. It was quite onerous, and I think there was certainly some things that could have been done to change that. But it was based on a traditional set of values too. But again, any time you try to legislate morals, it gets very, very difficult to do them justice. But the cultural Marxism, the feminists, the radical feminists of the time, and remember their catch cries were all sex is rape, masculinity is toxic, and a marriage is a power relationship. And the courts sort of took on some of the aspects of that. To change their views, and they sort of reduced it to an economic metric. They threw the economic ruler over the top of it as far as who got the resources. But it's something that, whilst again, which is typical of the left, they come in on there's an injustice in the system. It's inherently unjust and it's got to be fixed. But they end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so now we've got a no-fault system, which really impoverishes men more than anything else and encourages women to leave. So people don't see through a marriage. They'll hit a hard time and shoot through rather than sort of pass through that valley and into a different form of relationship. We've got a rise in single-parent households. We've got a huge rise in fatherless sons. Has it helped society? No, it hasn't. It's helped some women, and fair enough too, for those that are in abusive relationships.
Women like Susan Ryan, who made a career out of it.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that those women, they profit very well out of the narrative, don't they? They keep pushing that story.
Because there was grounds for divorce historically before the no-fault divorce instituted in 1975. Adultery, if you were deserted, refusal to consummate the marriage, habitual cruelty, mm-hmm. rape, sodomy, bestiality, drunkenness or intoxication by drugs, or frequent convictions, imprisonment, attempts to murder or unlawfully kill or inflict grievous bodily harm, failure to pay maintenance. It goes on. The list goes on and on. There was grounds for divorce. It's just you had to prove a fault. But suddenly there's a contract. Your marriage contract is worth less than the contract that you and I could have in a business arrangement.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Well, because they reframed it. The radical feminists reframed the whole concept. As you know, one of their tenets was all sex is rape. I mean, that was one of their starting positions, and that the marriage was really just a power relationship. That the man had the power, and they had to equalise that power sharing agreement. We see it today with domestic violence thing, where they've produced a spectrum of domestic violence, where it's just as inappropriate for the man to take control of the remote control when they're watching telly. Somehow that's an egregious sort of sin. And I suppose here's always the trouble. You take an institution like marriage, which is the bedrock or the foundation that you build prosperous societies on, and if you destroy that, as the cultural Marxists did want to, because they saw that as an impediment to them implementing their utopia. So whilst on the surface of it, it's about equality and getting a fair go, and they dirtied it up with the narrative. All sex is rape, masculinity is toxic, and it's about power. But to denigrate it as an institution, so that they could push forward with their utopia. Are we better off? I mean, let's ask the question. Are we better off today than we were in 1975?
Let's ask that question. We'll go to a break and we'll come straight back and let's see if we can answer that question or dig into it. At least you are listening to TNT Radio.
Big news, news, news.
A story which contains more than first meets the ear.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Russia has vowed revenge on Ukraine after the Kremlin came under attack in the heart of Moscow in what Russia says was a failed attempt to assassinate President Vladimir Putin. US presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has vowed to pardon WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange if he's elected in 2024. And NATO is reportedly planning to open its first office in Japan as the US-led military bloc seeks to increase collaboration with Tokyo in cyberspace.
Free speech is in our DNA.
Experimental vaccines will never change that.
Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Yeah, even there. Never miss out on the news and views of the big issues of the day. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio.
Or download the TNT Radio app for free.
From the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
I'm talking to former Labor supporter John McBride about this book by former Minister Hawke, Government Minister Susan Ryan, the deceased former minister. The book is Women and Whitlam, and obviously eulogising what no-fault divorce meant to the women's movement. And we're asking the question, are we actually any better off as a result of no-fault divorce?
Yeah, well, that's how do you answer it, really? I know of many men, myself included, that felt like we got a rough deal out of the family law court as far as assets, et cetera, and of course, the maintenance. It's interesting to note, though, that after the no-fault divorce came in the family court, it was operating, and it's operating, remember, on a different set of legal principles. It's not just justice under the law. It was a thing called social justice. So they were already sort of poisoned against men, and there's plenty of men out there that have got stories about how it's biased against them. But one of the things that did rise up in the 80s and 90s was de facto relationships. men saw it, saw what could happen to them under the Family Law Act, and decided, well, I just simply won't commit to a marriage and fall under that act. So what the feminists then were able to achieve was they codified de facto relationships. They said if you're in a relationship for more than 2 years, well, that's pretty much a marriage, and therefore the same conditions apply. So there was no escape for us. And it's also interesting to note when you look at it that back in the day, in 75, the fundamental economic unit was a single-wage household. And it's worth noting, too, that the wife at that time would spend a lot of time food preparing, doing the shopping. Supermarkets had just sort of taken off, and food appliances and such. We were liberating the women with technology, and the household was run a lot more efficiently than they were in the 50s and 60s. So they had more time on their hands. That's all changed now, of course, because what's happened is as women went into the workforce, the system, for some strange reason, decided that it now took two wages to buy a house, as it does now, unless you're on a terribly good wicket. So the economics of the time were different as well. And I think it was fair to say that there was that economic breakthrough that did recognise the effort that the woman put in to raise the family, to run a household. This was a full-time job. It's not like it is today. The conveniences that modern women have, they just weren't apparent back there in the 70s either. So it's important, I suppose, to put into that economic perspective about just how much labour was involved in running a house. So are we better off? I can't see that we are, Dame. What did we get? Fred Niles told us that it would be the end of marriage. We've ended up with gay marriage. Marriage is just, in one sense, you've got this state institution of marriage, and then you've got the sort of the societal one that we used to have under a traditional society, which is that, you know, there's a lifelong union. They're not the same. The law now doesn't respect that or see that as it is. They see it more as a sort of an economic relationship. And of course, a lot of people, as I said before, the rise in single parent households, fatherless sons and daughters, and the social problems and financial problems from that. The other side of that, of course, was also what went hand in hand with that act was the single mother support. And also at the time you had the influence of the pill, plus a permissiveness that was coming through society, the sexual liberation and what have you. So there was a sort of that wave crashed in 75, and we're still trying to really, really sort of deal with it. But our focus isn't... I'd say our focus had been distracted with all the other things that have gone on. And then we've now got transgenderism and...
So that's a direct result. That's a direct result of it.
Yeah, well, I tend to think it's the transgenderism is the Frankenstein's monster of the of the radical feminists. They wanted effeminate males. Well, here they are.
But they don't really. It's not true, is it? Because you find that women don't want effeminate males ultimately.
Well, most women don't. The majority, but they're not the ones leading. The majority are not the ones leading the charge. The radical feminists are the minority, people like Susan Ryan who make a lifestyle out of it and a career out of it. And you've got university calls run on it on this theme.
Well, it's an ideological bureaucracy that's built around the Family Law Act of 1975, and that we're all left to deal with. And people make money out of it, good money out of it. There's specific awards to journalists called the Eva Awards, which highlight, you know.
Eva Cox.
The Eva Awards, which are for women. Yeah, not Eva Cox, but yeah, obviously, but to highlight, you know, journalists trying to make a difference in this area for, you know, domestic violence, the champion women.
Mm. Well, if they could just show us how to work out, if they can please show us which principles we should now apply to the transgender movement, because the transgender movement basically taken the radical feminist movement to heart and is now championing their feelings. And of course, but you know, the radical feminist was based more on emotion than it was on logic. So if they could just solve that problem for us and tell us where we should fall on it, that'd be great. But right now they're tearing themselves apart because they've created a monster, and their argument is essentially the same argument they had back in the 70s, which are, you know, all males are toxic, and especially those that are now in dresses.
Well, they're addicted to that creation, that monster they've created. There's an addiction to it now as well, isn't there? And now as a result, like you say, men thought, okay, we'll go de facto, we'll get around it that way. We can't get around it that way. So now there's like a cohort of men that just don't want to be in relationships with women at all.
That's true. Yeah,
so many single women around, so many single mothers around too that have let go of a marriage. Maybe they should have stayed and worked harder at it. Is it, yeah, you're better off. And can you build another relationship again in your 40s and 50s or whatever that you had when you were younger?
Well, you can build a relationship, but you can't build a long-term one from 40 onwards, can you, really? You've gone through your 20s and 30s together is a bit different. So there's a vacuum there. And I think it's really when you view the landscape, you can see the carnage and the destruction and the rest of it. And you think, well, isn't this just the inevitable result? Wasn't this really what you're after in the first place?
But it's a societal inability to talk about it too, isn't it, John? Because this once upon a time, I would have never even had this conversation because I would have been too intimidated to actually have this conversation because of the institutionalization of books like Women and Whitlam.
Yeah, well, are we shy simply because we've been beaten around the head for so long anyway, which is a typical tactic of the, of the left. If it has a position, of course, and if you've got a counter position to it, well, then obviously that you're violent or you're have some sort of phobia, depending on what particular item they're talking about, and you need... You need hate speech, which is why they've weaponized lawfare against us. And you see this with the Green Senator and Hanson at the moment. I've seen some of her tweets, so I hope Hanson takes her to court and says, well, exactly where did you get this sudden rise in sensibilities when you were telling people to F off and do this and do that? Mm-hmm. And you've raised a son that tells white people, isn't it great that white people are dying? It's like, but then suddenly you've got sensibilities. Yeah. Interesting, isn't it?
Joe McBride, thanks so much for joining me on the Damon Richardson Show.
Appreciate it, Dame. Talking soon. Ciao, mate.
You're listening to TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
If you listen to my show weeknights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on TNT Radio, you've heard me talk about how every Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives voted against a bill in January which would protect babies who are born alive during an attempted abortion. It's who the Democrats are. And last week in the Colorado State Legislature, 27 House Democrats voted against making indecent exposure to minors a felony. It's who they are. The bill would elevate such behavior from a Class 1 misdemeanor to a Class 6 felony if committed in view of a person who's under 18. Leslie Herod is one of those Dems who voted no.
These types of laws have been used to ban drag shows, to target individuals who use the restroom of the sex that they identify with, a public restroom, to charge them with felony charges.
And so what's wrong with that? If exposure is taking place at these events, arrest them. The measure passed with unanimous Republican support and 19 of 46 Democrats voting yes. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick. Watching my nieces grow, play, and learn is amazing, but not every child gets to be carefree. 1 in 6 kids in the U.S. are hungry. This breaks my heart, and it's something that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and gives it to families in need. To help, visit feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Damian Richardson and the Aussie Cossack on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Well, that was funny to hear that again. I don't know if everybody else has been wondering, but I've been wondering what happened to my co-host. Where'd he go? What happened to the Cossack? I was like, oh, have someone finally got him out of the consulate? But no, not at all. Apparently, he's got his own show now on Sundays. He's outgrown me already. He's only here for a couple of weeks. He's already outgrown me to go into greener pastures, as they say. He might want to tell us about it. Aussie Cossack, are you on the line, mate? I think I can hear you fidgeting around.
G'day, mate. Saturday, 6 p.m., the correct time and place. Is on the TNT Radio app or web browser. So, yeah, guys, tune in. And that's what the permanent slot will be now, Saturday, 6 p.m.
Saturday, 6 p.m., mate. And what's it called? Just Aussie Cossack or?
The Aussie Cossack Intel, whatever you want. Well, it was really called the Aussie Cossack Show, but we can make it up as we go along, isn't it?
You should have thought of that before I asked.
The Aussie Cossack Show will do.
Excellent.
Well, look, I'm very happy that – you know, there's an opportunity to bring out the news, especially from a position looking at the geopolitical position we've got today. You know, Russia, Ukraine, Australia, and how Australia fits into the picture. You know, there are big things going on, but we're not out of the picture, unfortunately. And I'd love to say Australia's not involved in anything, but unfortunately, we are.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a bit of a. It's been escalated, hasn't it? Because there was an attack. There was two drones attacked the Kremlin last night. And Russian forces used radar equipment to disable them. There was no casualties and the president was unhurt apparently, but they did call it an assassination attempt against Vladimir Putin.
Unverified footage appears to show an object flying toward the dome of the Kremlin before bursting into flames. One of two drones brought down, said the Kremlin, using electronic radar assets. The Russian president wasn't there at the time, according to his spokesman. The Kremlin's press office described the incident as a planned terrorist act, vowing that Russia reserves the right to take retaliatory measures where and when it sees fit.
Well, look, this has never, ever happened. Not in my lifetime, not in anyone's lifetime. Even in World War II, you know, when we were fighting the Germans, they never managed to hit the Kremlin. And the Kremlin being such an iconic building, hitting the dome of one of the most important buildings, or the most important building in Russia, and in the Soviet Union, and in the Russian Empire, it's a historical moment. And there's an expectation from the Russian people that Russia must retaliate. We can't be seen, and when I say we, I mean people in Russia, Russian heritage, because it affects Russians everywhere. This is a symbol of national pride. And the Ukrainians straight away have thrown their hands up and said, it wasn't us, it wasn't us. Hmm. Well, who else could it have been? Hmm. Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, very conveniently, I would say even very suspiciously, at that moment, was in Finland. And he hasn't gone back to Kiev, hasn't gone back to Ukraine. He's traveled from Finland onto another European Union country, which is very suspicious that he was conveniently not in the country, because the Russians have declared that they will retaliate, and they have said that they will retaliate you know, at their own pace. The Russian ambassador to the United States, Antonov, who I really, you know, like, he's very strong, he's very outspoken, as a Russian ambassador should be, but you know, he said that Russia will respond to this insolent and presumptuous terrorist attack. We will answer when we consider it necessary. So, we, you know, a lot of Russians are saying something needs to be done, because if we allow the Ukrainians to get away with this, then, you know, what kind of reputation does Russia leave for itself? Then, you know, anyone can do that. It has to be stopped. And I'm sorry to say, but there are people in Russia saying, well, why don't you hit the button, Vladimir? Why don't you use the firepower that you have in your arsenal? But no, Vladimir Putin is very kind. He's conservative. And this is where the West needs to understand. They should be kissing Putin's feet and thanking him for being the president. Because if the president was Prigozhin or Kadyrov, the Chechen leader, or somebody else, you know, hardline Soviet general, there wouldn't be any warnings or any polite threats. It would be serious action. So Putin is.
Let me put this to you, Cossack. Is it possible that there was no, that this was a false flag, that the Russians did it themselves? Because that, like, those drones look absolutely impotent. What I saw actually hit the Kremlin. It was almost embarrassing.
Well, in if you look from the Western media's point of view, they'll throw whatever disinformation they can at it, and they'll blame. They've blamed Russia. As I said, the ABC News has blamed Russia, and a whole wave of Western media outlets have said this is possibly Vladimir Putin attacking himself. I think that's a ridiculous thing to propose. There's no reason why Russia would attack itself.
Gives it the opportunity to escalate then, doesn't it? Is that not a possibility that then it could escalate the war and have cause to do that?
Well, to be quite honest, Russia is in control of the situation and they could escalate it. They are self, you know, restricting their response. No one's stopping them from escalating their response, but Russia's been, from the very beginning, to have this one hand tied behind its back approach to the whole special military operation. In fact, you know, we're in our 14th month of conflict now, and Russia still formally has not declared war on Ukraine, and formally Ukraine has not declared war on Russia. And I thought to myself, well, this could be the red line. In Russia, they always talk about a red line. They threaten Ukrainians with not crossing the red line. They say, if you cross the red line. Now, what is the red line? You know, the Ukrainians are bombing Russian oil depots in Krasnodar, in Crimea. And this is Krasnodar is Russian mainland territory. It's always been Russia. There's not even argument who it belongs to. And you'd think that would be a red line that's crossed. Earlier in the conflict, they've bombed the Kursk region, the Bryansk region, the Belgorod region. These aren't like regions in dispute. This is actual Russian mainland territory. And every time this happens, the Russian government or some spokesperson says, oh, this is going to be, if you one more thing like this, you'll cross the red line, you'll cross the red line. A lot of people in Russia are saying, well, what else needs to happen for Russia to respond to this properly? Now, an attack on
the Kremlin. Is it possible that it was the third party? Is it possible it was the third party, knowing that it's a tinderbox there?
Absolutely. It's quite, you could contemplate that it could be a third party. I mean, who would want to, who would benefit from this is the question. I mean, there's already a conflict going. It's not like that would benefit someone by pushing Russia and Ukraine against each other. They're pretty much at war anyway. I don't know. Well, maybe they might find the wreckage of the drone. And that's the other thing. Australia supplies drones under Albanese. Australia supplies drones to the Ukrainian army. Now, I was always against that. I said that's a terrible idea for Australia to supply any weapons. Let me put it this way. What if, and this is a hypothetical scenario, but it's completely, entirely possible, what if the Russians find the drone wreckage or a drone wreckage, whether it's the drone that hit the Kremlin or a drone that hit some other Russian territory, Kursk, Belgorod, Krasnodar, Crimea. And what if it turns out that that drone was made in Victoria and it says, made in Australia by SIPAC, courtesy of Albanese. This is the thing. It's such a bad idea for Australia to supply any weapons. And this is where Australia is on, unfortunately, thanks to Albanese and thanks to ScoMo, Australia's in a dangerous predicament because they're considered a combatant in the war by Russia. And Russia has very clearly said, any country that supplies weapons will be considered a combatant. Australia has nothing to gain by sending these, they call them pizza box drones. They're made of cardboard, you know, ecologically friendly and biodegradable. It's a bit ridiculous.
It looked like it when it hit the Kremlin. It looked like it was pretty ecologically
friendly.
So maybe
it was an Australian drone.
But Australians would sort of be proud as well. Like, look, our drone got through, man. It got through, you know.
I don't know what's there to be proud of. But it wasn't much of an explosion, but it's the strategically it means nothing to the impact of the war. But in terms of a historical event, this will be etched into Russian history. I mean,
given its war, Napoleon before Hitler too couldn't take Moscow. But given it's a war, they would have been concerned that there would be infiltrating of Russian airspace. Is it awkward at all for the Russians it's not a false flag and it is a foreign operative? They've actually gotten through so easily to reach the heart of the Kremlin.
Yeah, there are reports from Moscow that that night there were about 200 drones detected all up in one night. And there are drones all the time hitting different civilian targets, military targets, strategic targets. So, yeah, the Russians probably weren't prepared. And it's unfortunate that the Russians weren't prepared. And I've often said that, you know, maybe God has sent this sort of mini war, this small war to Russia, to save Russia in the event of a big war. You know, a lot of the tactics, which were outdated, or the weaponry, are now being upgraded, and Russians are improving their tactics and making drones of their own and improving their anti-drone technology. And this is something that we wouldn't have been able to do if there was no war with Ukraine, and there was just a big war in the future, if there was World War III. So the benefit here for Russia, even though it's a painful process, that they're learning through experience. And that's one thing that the Russian military will have up its sleeve, is a great knowledge and experience and training fighting with modern weapons. And in fact, to be quite honest, the whole world is watching. The whole world is learning. The Western countries, especially China, watching very closely and learning. And they are adjusting their own tactics, adjusting their own technology according to what's happening in this war, because this is a war unlike any other, where a lot of the tactics are outdated thanks to the advent of drones. And by the way, Russia using drones themselves very effectively, thanks in part to Iran and the technology that they supplied, the Garand drones, very, very effective. And last night, the Russians sent, you know, a huge counter attack in missiles, but I think they're waiting for Zelensky to return. You know, this is the first time that the Russians have actually said that they will consider, you know, targeting Zelensky in a tit for tat. And even though the Ukrainians deny that that was their drone, the Russians have said, no, it was a Ukrainian drone. They're considering that as a Ukrainian terrorist attack. And maybe that's the reason why this surprise, unplanned, unexpected trip that Zelensky is now on overseas, he's safe. He was in Finland for a day. Now he's off to, I think it's the Netherlands. They've that he's floating around. I wouldn't be surprised if after the Netherlands he announces that he has to visit some other country, Belgium or somewhere else. So he wants to stay out of Ukraine, because if he's in Ukrainian territory.
What do you think the chances of peace are, Cossack? Like, I know I saw that Pope Francis, of all people, was coming back from the region, suggesting that there was a possibility that he wouldn't have discussed yet, that of brokering a peace deal between the two combatants.
Well, I wouldn't have too much faith in Pope Francis. I mean, the Catholic Church and their policies of interference into the religious affairs of Ukraine, especially Western Ukraine, trying to undermine the Orthodox Church, which has been there for centuries, were no hope at all. And that's actually part of the conflict. This is, religion is playing a major part in the conflict. And we can see what's happening there, with churches being burnt down and confiscated and stormed, and clergy being arrested. So I don't think the Pope has any strong moral ground to be talking about these kind of things. They know what they've been doing there. They've been provocating the situation. But someone that I think could solve the situation is Donald Trump. And he gave an interview, I think it was yesterday, to Nigel Farage at GB News. And he said, if I was in power, I would finish this in 24 hours. If he was reelected, 24 hours it would take Donald Trump to finish the conflict. And I mean finish it not in a military way, but to sit down with Vladimir Putin over a cup of tea and just sort it out as men. Putin's never sat down with Zelensky as an adversary or as a worthy equal. There's no respect factor there. But I sense that between Putin and Trump, there is respect.
So what factors would have to come into play for that to be the case? What would they talk about?
I could imagine, hypothetically, let's just say, a peaceful solution. I think the way the borders stand now, that's very close to what Russia is claiming anyway. And, you know, the conflict would have been over if it wasn't for NATO weapons, if it wasn't for NATO sending weapons, sending money, and artificially keeping Ukraine alive. It's like a country that's on life support. If it wasn't for NATO, if it wasn't for these billions of dollars which are constantly being pumped into there, the country is bankrupt. The country is dysfunctional. It's a failed state, but it's kept alive. It's like on life support artificially by NATO, by pumping in weapons. And if you stop that, if you stop the weapons and you stop the mercenaries which are being sent in from Western Europe, from countries like Australia, unfortunately, it's a black mark on Australia's history that Australia's involved in this too. That's all, to fix the conflict, to stop the conflict, that's all we need to do. Stop sending weapons, stop NATO. And I firmly and squarely place the blame on NATO.
So we've got 30, 40 seconds. You're going to do your first show on Saturday at 6 p.m., Cossack, right here on TNT Radio. What can we look forward to from your first show, mate?
All sorts of outrageous topics, but I won't hold back at all. You know, for the people out there listening, it'll be someone in their corner fighting for them, fighting for the people, as I always have been for the last few years. And to the politicians and to the you know, the corrupt globalists out there, look out. You know, I'm coming in hard and fast. So tune in 6 o'clock Saturday to TNT Radio. And look, very important to note, we do want peace and friendship. We don't want a nuclear war, but I want to remind everyone, Russia will consider that option if it has to. And we can't be involved in this. We want to keep Australia out of it, which is another really important thing I need to focus on. We all need to focus on is Australian neutrality. Let's save Australia.
Cossack,
let's not get involved in World War III.
Thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show. You're listening to TNT Radio.